Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Here's a little secret you may already know. The Wildside News is actually more than a radio show. It's your own private on-demand source to the amazing people who are researching, adventuring, braving the unknown. Anytime you're ready, you can choose where you want to go next. Coming up, segment one of just such an adventure as two newlywed adventurers set off to find out what it means to be caribou.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
You are about to hear one of the most amazing stories of adventure of the 21st century. In April 2003, Carsten Hoyer and his bride Leanne set out on an Arctic trek to follow the legendary porcupine caribou herd from the wintering grounds in northern Canada, over 500 miles of frozen trails, biting blizzards, grizzlies, in a test of human endurance, to find out what being caribou really is. The story drives home to our modern world, better than any of recent times, why the preservation of the calving areas located on the coastal tundra of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge must be recognized and held sacred for the soul of the wild creatures, who will tell us their story as enacted each year for the past 27,000 years through this amazing story of being caribou. This is a special edition of the Wildside News. I empower you to come along during the next 2 hours so that you too can come to know what being caribou is all about. And so the journey begins. Today I was listening to the President speak about the emerging global war on terror, and it just seems sometimes that the stresses of our world are overwhelming at times, and the challenges are enormous, and it's hard to find our way. And even the global war on terror oftentimes can be associated with, at least according to some people, the demands that are being placed on our future for issues such as oil in particular. And these issues then translate right into the ground here, including stresses potentially on places like Anwar, where oil becomes the issue, quite honestly, at least from the perspective of our own national security. And so the answers to these questions become very complex. And sometimes it's very hard to find our way. But every once in a while, a person emerges who decides to challenge these kinds of future visions with a whole different way of looking at things and trying to find out different levels of truth. And joining us today is an extraordinary person, Carsten Hoyer, who has written a book recently called Being Caribou, just out by the great people at Mountaineers Books. Carsten, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thanks a lot, Sydney.
Being Caribou is a story of an adventure that you and your wife took on, where you decided that you were going to find out what it meant to be caribou, and we're going to talk at length about that. But first, let's talk a little bit about you and your background that kind of helped to lead to this extraordinary challenge. So give us a background on kind of, first of all, about your career and your experience.
Sure. So right now I'm living in Canada. We live in British Columbia, sort of north central. On one side of the valley where we live is the Canadian Rockies, and on the other side is the Caribou Mountains. And through the course of the last 10 years of my life, I've taken my biological training, so my degree in ecology, and applied it both to work in wildlife biology in countries as far and wide as Slovakia and Poland and South Africa, And as close as to home as Jasper National Park and Banff National Park in Alberta, and as far north as Avavik National Park, which is the extreme northwest corner of Canada's Yukon Territory, and so it borders directly onto Alaska and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And so I was posted up there over the past few years, and having grown up in a very different environment in the city of Calgary, which would be very, very much like to Denver, for instance, in terms of geography, out on the plains, but very close to the Rocky Mountains, you know, definitely below tree line. But to me, the Arctic environment before I went up there on this assignment as a park ranger was very foreign. And I didn't really know what to expect. I mean, I certainly had some ideas and some notions and some dreams of what I'd like to see and what I'd like to experience. But when I got up there, I set off on my first patrol of this national park, which is very remote. The nearest town is hundreds of miles away, so we would fly in with a small plane with tundra tires, land on the Arctic tundra, throw out two inflatable rafts, and we would raft down the interior river of this national park for 10 days. And that was how we would conduct our park patrols. Well, the very first patrol that I did in spring 2001, and spring in the Arctic is late June, we encountered this caribou herd of 123,000 animals that was crossing through the park, swimming across this river, on its way to their calving grounds, their preferred calving ground on the coastal plain of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And this herd of 123,000 animals, I mean, it's not like watching elk in Yellowstone National Park pass in front of your vehicle, or, you know, a few deer in the Maine woods pass in front of your house or your tent camp. This went on for 2 full days and 2 full nights of animals coursing across this river, and not only the caribou, but all the animals and all the life that they tow along that Arctic landscape with them. So that this huge sort of tundra landscape of rolling hills and mountains, and this deep river canyon, had virtually been silent before the caribou started arriving, and all of a sudden it was just throbbing with life. At one point we saw 8 grizzly bears, you know, in various stages of being downstream, hoping for some caribou that didn't make it across to wash up. Others lying in the bushes waiting in ambush to scare caribou that were coming out of the water. We saw wolves, foxes, golden eagles dive bombing down, peregrine falcons. I mean, it was just amazing. And then after 2 days, and again, you know, this is all from the perspective of somebody who's never experienced anything like this before, except maybe, you know, through the written word, in stories about what it used to be like on the plains where I grew up in Calgary with a bison. And this is really that level of life still up in the Arctic. And so after 2 days of being immersed in this and not being able to sleep because of all the dramas that were constantly unfolding around us, the last few hundred animals climbed up over the ridge and disappeared to the west. And after having been a part of that energy and part of that power, it was really hard to kind of be left in its wake, in its silent wake, and a huge part of me wanted to go with it, to follow those animals over that ridge, and to continue to observe and feel the events that would unfold as they continued to pass across the landscape, and also to satisfy curiosity, like, where the heck were these animals going, and why were they traveling with such motivation and such force across this landscape? So focused on getting somewhere. Where was that place and why was it important? And so those are the questions that sort of swam around in my head as I continued on my patrol north down the river, and then we got picked up in the Arctic Ocean and flew back to the park headquarters office, which is in the nearest town of Inuvik in the Northwest Territories. And I got back, and, you know, part of this caribou herd was still inside me rattling around, and it led me to books, to reports, to past television documentaries, to find out. I mean, I was just thirsty for knowledge to find out more about this caribou herd. And that's when I learned about where they were headed, was their preferred calving grounds on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, an area that by, you know, the best archaeological geological estimates that they've been going back to year after year for at least the last 27,000 years. And I learned about this proposal that's been swimming around in the background and debated in very hotly contested issues. Most Americans know, probably the largest environmental issue in all of the U.S. right now, of this proposal to drill for oil in the exact place where this caribou herd goes to have their calves every year. And so that really sort of interested me, concerned me, and I started thinking, wow, like, do people know? Do people understand that it's this amount of life, that it's this concentrated life that's heading to that place? And I wanted to really share that those feelings, those initial powerful feelings I've had of the caribou, and let it be known, because I think one of the greatest tragedies in the world would be if we sacrifice something or compromise something or lose something without ever really understanding what's there that we've lost. And I think that would be a great tragedy in terms of this caribou herd and Arctic refuge. So I started thinking about how to bring this story alive for people. And I got talking to my wife, Leanne Allison, who's a very accomplished adventurer, mountaineer in her own right, and we'd both done a trip a couple years before, walking from Yellowstone up to the Yukon, to try to bring alive the story of wildlife that need to travel between parks and reserves and wildlife corridors. And we thought, could we do something like that with the caribou? Could we help to bring their story alive? And so over a period of months, this idea began to hatch of trying to be caribou, trying to travel like this caribou herd, travel with the caribou herd and experience everything they do, the wolf pack encounters, the half-frozen river crossings, the blizzards, the hordes of bugs that emerge in early summer, and experience everything that they go through to get to the calving grounds and back to their winter range again, and in that way try to sort of articulate the caribou's voice, try to articulate the value of the Arctic refuge that up till now we've always been talking about in barrels of oil, billions of barrels of oil, when in fact the caribou's voice has gone unheard. So we thought the value would be in everything they go through to get there and back again.
Well, now there's some challenges here. First of all, I'm just trying to imagine how it is that you happen to find a mate who would tolerate such a vision. Did you ever discuss this when you got... when you got married? Listen, is it possible that you want to accompany me on some of the most extraordinarily difficult challenges that you'll ever face as a human being?
Well, isn't that the vow that everybody takes in marriage?
I don't think so. No.
Well, Leanne and I have quite a long history. In fact, we first met when we were 5 years old in kindergarten.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, we go back a fair ways, and we kind of fell out of contact with one another for about 13 years. Huh. And then it so happened in university I was working as a canoe instructor for one of her best friends. And after I'd been working for 2 weeks, her friend, who was my boss for that summer, called Leanne up and said, "You got to come down to the canoe club and meet this guy that's working for me. He's like the male version of you."
That's funny.
So we met, over a decade later, and we kind of led these parallel lives in terms of interest. And a lot of those interests did revolve around traveling in the outdoors and adventuring. And so I think we really are kindred spirits. And so, immediately when I started to think of this idea, Leanne's response wasn't thinking of all the reasons why we shouldn't do it. Mm. She was really excited about the reasons why we should. And we certainly, over the many months and, in fact, a full year of preparations that it took to get ready for this trip, we certainly encountered a lot of sort of naysayers or people trying to dissuade us from even trying to do this. And quite frankly, there were tons of unknowns. I mean, most of the time when you set off on a trip, and certainly on our Yellowstone to Yukon expedition, this was the case, you make a route plan. You decide, okay, I'm going to travel here, this valley, go along this ridge, and you sit down with hundreds of maps, and you work it all out, the distances, the elevation gained and lost, where you would put food caches, how long it's going to take, and you develop a schedule and goals and destinations. And this trip with the caribou really, you know, we sort of started heading down that road in our minds. It's like, wait a minute. We don't know where these caribou are going to go because, quite frankly, their migration routes change from one year to the next, both in timing and route. I mean, they could take one mountain range from the Yukon up to Alaska one year and completely switch to another one the next year. And they might even start up one and then kind of change their mind halfway through because of whether it's snow or weather or other things we don't even understand, and adopt an entirely different route. And so there's a huge amount of unpredictability and lack of things to hang the future on for us. And I think that became the biggest challenge as we started to prepare for this trip is all the unknowns, all the unpredictability. Unpredictabilities that we were going to head out into, and so we couldn't put one food cache in before we left. We didn't know if we were heading for 4 months or 6 months or 7 months, and we had to put all our faith in these wild animals as our guides, and really sort of surrender ourselves to all their whims.
That, to me, in reading your book, was one of the most amazingly difficult things to perceive, is how, as a couple, or an individual, but this was a couple, you make the decision to head out on an uncharted course, and as well, not just an uncharted course, but an uncharted course through some extraordinarily difficult terrain. I know that you did a lot of research in terms of there have been radio collared studies of the caribou movements, and so you had a concept of where they go historically and how they might travel, but to head out into that terrain with everything on your back, you know, how did you prepare? I mean, what, let's talk a little bit about kind of the technical side, the gear side of this. How did you imagine, what did you put in your pack? How did you make those decisions? Because those had to be extremely difficult decisions.
No, they were, I joke in the book, in the prologue, that sort of our collective Arctic experience amounted to a couple months, and most of those experiences were on a well-stocked raft, river raft, running down a river. So it's a completely different idea when you start thinking about traveling overland. And really all Leanne and I had to tap into were our mountaineering skills. And so we really did put, I mean, we considered a lot of different options, but what we really decided in the end is because we have to be able to sort of pack up and go at a moment's notice when the caribou start to move, or if they stop, we have to be able to pitch this tent. You know, it has to be very quick to set up. It has to be portable. It has to be light so that we don't get tired from carrying excessive weight. And we have to be able to pitch it on a rocky ridge or in a swamp or absolutely anywhere. We sort of melded sort of mountaineering technology with this unorthodox notion of following a wild herd of animals across the tundra. And so we dried all our own food. We packaged it up into, I guess, balls, for lack of a better word of describing it, that were wrapped with tape and garbage bags and crushed newspaper for padding, and then had those all sitting in a warehouse. One town on the Canadian side and another town on the Alaskan side where we could call in for them as we were going, as we were running out of food, we'd call in to have them delivered by bush plane and dropped out of the sky essentially to our location. We would communicate that over a satellite phone, but all of a sudden, okay, we're going to take a satellite phone, so now we have to have some way, means of charging it over these many months. And so that led to a whole other arm of research into the latest solar panels and recharging technologies. And then once we had that kind of figured out, we thought, well, if we got some battery power, maybe we can do some filming of this trip as well. And so that led to a whole thing where Leanne actually headed off on a week-long course in filmmaking. And you know, to her incredible credit, not only did this trip, but pulled off an award-winning film about the journey as well.
Well, there were lots of decisions. I mean, it's one thing to take off cross-country with a heavy pack. And by the way, what kind of weight were you each carrying?
It varied depending on how recently we received a food supply. So mm-hmm. right after a food supply, you know, our packs weighed somewhere in the order of 60 to 70 pounds.
Those are very heavy packs.
Yeah, and at one point, you know, when we, I don't know if you remember the book, we're in the sort of heart of the post-calving rush. We're just doing all we can to keep up. And in order to avoid having to wait for a plane to come in, we actually carried a whole month of food. So that was 90 pounds once you added up the month of food and all our equipment.
But here's the thing that now, this is the thing. So you got these heavy packs, but you're also going through snow and over mountain passes, and that's as strenuous as it gets.
Yeah, and we really didn't have a good sense, I think, of what the snow conditions were going to be like before we left. And part of the reason the caribou migrate south after they calve is they're trying to get back below tree line, so latitudinal tree line, before the winter winds hit. Because what the winter winds do is they take the snow, and there's not tons of snow, but there's enough snow, and it just packs it to concrete-like consistency out on the open tundra. So the caribou can't dig down to get at their food, so they migrate down below tree line to spend the winter, where the trees, although they're kind of these stubby, small, short trees, not anything like we're used to down south here, but these trees still do provide enough shelter that the snow remains very soft, and so the caribou can crater down. Well, it makes for great feeding for the caribou in winter, but it makes for horrendous traveling. I mean, it's kind of like walking through this sugar-like consistency of snow that collapsed underneath you. So when we started out from the Porcupine River, which is kind of the northern extent of their winter range, it's still treed in that area, and we set off, you know, presuming that we could just sort of ski in the wake of this caribou herd. And what we found was, even with these long, 8-foot-long skis, our weight was enough that we would just plunge through right to the ground. There was absolutely no support in the snowpack. And so we were wallowing, and within minutes of leaving that very first day, and already overwhelmed with the whole notion of sort of heading off into this great unknown on this uncharted route, and not knowing even how many months we were going to head off for, we sort of make the realization within the first few minutes that we're not even going to be able to travel for the first while in the way we'd assumed we would. We were carrying our skis and having to walk in the trenches that the caribou had left behind, very much like balancing along a narrow, slippery log for kilometer after kilometer. It's very exhausting.
That type of snow is impossible because it's there is no traction. I've been in that, and it's as difficult as it is. You just each foot just sinks. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like walking on frozen ball bearings.
Yeah.
To some extent.
Yeah.
But you know what? It was a neat thing too, because immediately we just had to. The only way forward was to follow exactly in the caribou's footsteps. Mm-hmm. So it became very metaphorical. You know how much even we had to give up our notions of how we're going to do the trip right in the first few minutes. All of a sudden we're carrying these skis instead of using them. Now that all changed
mm-hmm.
as we did break out of tree line over the first few weeks, and we hit that concrete like
first few weeks. I like that.
No, yeah.
let's talk about that timing, because timing was a very critical thing. I mean, you were on foot. This wasn't the National Geographic expedition where you're kind of the helicopters drop you. They have search teams and they drop you within 500 yards of your of the herd. you know, you guys had to leave from a point and then try to find the caribou, which all by itself was a challenge, and try to catch up to them and then follow them. And we're going to talk about that takeoff point, but let's talk how it is that you came to decide literally when to leave. I mean, that's a big decision. Timing is critical.
Yes, no, certainly, and that would set up whether or not the whole journey was successful. And so the big question for us was, you know, are these caribou kind of milling around their winter range, or are they starting to migrate? And we didn't want to leave too early, because if they weren't migrating yet, we would expend sort of our valuable energy and food and enthusiasm kind of going in circles following these caribou and not sort of heading towards their calving grounds. So the timing was critical, but even from the biologist reports and the radio caller data and everything, that you just couldn't sort of discern from a distance on what was actually happening, whether the caribou were kind of starting to head north or not. And so what we decided to do is we flew in to a small village in the Yukon called Old Crow, and it's a Gwich'in village. Gwich'in being a sort of band of Athabasca native people who have lived up there for and their survival has been tied to the caribou for over 10,000 years now. And so these people, it's a small town, a handful of trucks that have been flown or barged in over the years. It sits along the Porcupine River, and on every table of the 400 residents, you know, as we went into their small cabins, there'd be a bowl of dried caribou meat out back. There'd be caribou skins hanging from the hunts the fall before, and everybody, the talk on the street would be like, in the rest of Canada during the hockey playoffs, but it wasn't about hockey, it was about caribou movement. And so these people are incredibly attuned to when the caribou might be through and which direction they might be going. But a lot of that talk, we soon realized, was very speculative. And people were within an hour of us arriving and asking questions about where caribou might be and what they might be doing. We got a whole host of answers, everything from that we were already too late, they'd already been through and over the Porcupine River and well north, to people saying we were way too early and we should wait till May,
right,
which is in early April. So Leanne and I immediately are sort of plunged into the state of confusion and back and forth. And then we happened upon this gentleman that figures very prominently as a character in the book at the beginning and the end, Randall Tutlici, a 50-something-year-old Gwich'in man, and he'd been out hunting the day before, and he had got a few caribou. And so we ended up at his doorstep and talked about what we'd like to set off and do. And, you know, he didn't have any immediate answers, and he didn't offer any opinions, unlike a lot of other people we'd run into, and he was very quiet and soft-spoken. But there was something about the look he gave us, the way he invited us in, and we had a lunch of caribou soup, that really sort of told Leanne and I that this was somebody whose advice we should listen very closely to. You know, it was more of it's hard to articulate, it was more of a sense or a feeling than anything else. And so over the course of the afternoon, he agreed that the next day he would take us to this place where he'd been hunting, about 60 miles outside of town, and we would go by snowmobile the next morning. And so off we headed, and sure enough, later that day, we encountered groups of hundreds of caribou crossing the river in the same spot. And yet, as we pitched camp that night, it was in a small trapper's cabin along the river, and the river's frozen at this time, of course. We're all uncertain, and even Randall's uncertain, whether indeed the caribou are migrating or not. And that night it gets dark, and we end up around the table by candlelight, and there's a small fire going in the wood stove. And Randall starts to tell all these incredible stories about times when he'd been hunting, and his boat had blown up and burned, and he'd had to do a combination of swimming and walking for weeks to get back to town, and stories about his grandfather, who had always known when to send out Randall and his brothers to go hunting, when the caribou would be coming through, and just the incredible power that he had, and Randall for giving us advice on the journey that lay ahead, and probably one of the most important pieces of advice he gave us was to listen to our dreams, to pay attention to our dreams. And that night, there was some old caribou skin hides lying around the cabin, and I made a nice bed for Leanne. And so she went to sleep, and I slept on the floor, and Randall slept on the bunk on the other side. And the next morning, we woke up and still uncertain, no caribou in sight now, still uncertain, should we head off and follow them, or should we still wait? And then Leanne recalled that she had a dream that night, and the dream had been of the Porcupine River, which was covered in, you know, a sheet of ice many feet thick and capped with snow at this point. She had a dream that that river had broken up. It had started to melt and flow. And that dream, like, I was kind of skeptical, you know, if you're this Native man has told us to pay attention to our dreams the night before, and now all of a sudden my wife was having this dream, and what did it all mean, and was it very believable? But Leanne's look assured me that it was true. Indeed, it was a very vivid dream. And I looked at Randall, and he had none of that sort of questioning or doubt in his eyes, and he just sort of quietly said, well, there's your answer. You guys got to get going. And so literally we packed up, and we found the most well-trodden trail that left the river, and we followed that up the first hill into our first forest and took our first footsteps. And that was how this incredible journey started.
Whenever you're ready, you can listen to the rest of the journey. It's a full hour and a half long reliving of this amazing tale. You can find the links to the next segment on today's website or anytime at wildsidenews.com. Just click on the Animal Archives and listen to the rest of Being Caribou. Coming up, another path to adventure as a young scientist starts his journey to discover if apes have any intelligence. What's he find out? Stay tuned.
The river's on the rise, swift and gentle like the breeze. It swallows everything but sky. It suffocates the trees. Here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? And does it even matter if I sing? If I sink or swim,
melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.